Thank you. Hallo? Hi, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. We are very happy to have here at Patrons Found NASA Experimental Publishing for the second time for another launch of their special issue. I will be very happy to be with Michael, the new director, and Lydia. So I'll give you the floor now.
Yeah, so maybe actually I'm going to do one thing I haven't done before, which is just to say, so this is the 17th special issue. Expo is a master's program that started in 2016. And each year we have three special issues which are partnered with a different institution and with a different guest editor and has extremely diverse forms. And it's an amazing accomplishment that all of these different projects, which are all collective, have been organized. And we celebrated, actually, a transition with the person who actually, there's one person, though, who's had a kind of finger in that whole series of special issues, and that is Amrit Malsu. So I think, indeed, it's an amazing accomplishment, and it's a kind of overwhelming thing that now I'm starting to learn all of the details of what it takes to actually try to put together and organize these, given all of the kind of bureaucratic difficulties and organizational difficulties. So yeah, it's 17. Yeah. And anyway, the format of the special issue is indeed a partner institution, as in this case, Page Not Found, and our guest editor, who is Lydia Pereira, who will describe maybe the concept behind the
this issue. Yeah, I can say a few words. I didn't prepare enough of my text here, so apologies if it won't go flowingly. But so the idea behind this special issue was to look into productive play. So we started looking into gamification, to our games and video games in particular are making us more and not less productive. To that effect, we not only looked at gamification, but also predatory monetization schemes within video games, such as microtransactions, downloadable content, and loot boxes, which, I'm not going to ruin the surprise yet. actually, you already ruined the surprise yourselves, so I'm not ruining anything. To that effect, indeed, we're looking at these blurred boundaries between productivity and play, and the spaces of leisure, which are still very much contested, especially when we are talking about different sex, different genders, different races, different abilities, etc., etc. So, I hope you enjoyed. I'm super, happy to be here today and to see all the amazing work that the students have done. You should be super proud of yourself. And, I'll try not to cry.
One lecture with Shira Chess, and one lecture with Corey Archangel. And tonight it's our pleasure also to be invited, and they kindly accepted to come with us, except Eckenhauser and Hausenberg. And Poon Bataille, who are a director of Platform Baker, to help us develop a discussion around regeneration and therapy within the digital arts in the moment. So I can give you the floor now. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you. Feels a little bit weird to take over the launch of the publication. So many people put so much work in, but it's super nice to be invited here. So thank you to the whole team of Expub and the students that we can be here. We were asked to talk a little bit about the economic side of a publication. So we have a slideshow. Be shown right there. This is the question tonight, right? Like, the economically responsible art book. We can go to the next slide. Because this shows what we are dealing with. Right, so, okay, what is the question? Maybe once more? This box found you for a reason, but how much money is left in the box for you? Plot for BK is a member-based organization that works throughout the Netherlands, and it says there quite succinctly and rightly, we research the role of art in society and take action for a better art policy. So we do events, we do publications, we do actions, we lobby, we try and create policy, and we do this because of our dear members who support us, so in principle we can be independent from any funders, the members themselves. And we were established back in 2012, so 10 years ago this year, as a reaction to the large budget cuts in the cultural sector. And this overview was made then by our predecessors. So yeah, I mean, Koen and me both were teens back then, so we didn't self-fund the organization ourselves, but we are the third generation core team. And yeah, I mean, as probably most of you remember, or some of you remember, a lot of art institutions closed back then, large-scale precarization set in. So we, as an organization, were founded to ask questions, okay, what about the position of the worker in the arts? This also recently became very relevant again in the corona crisis, right? So because in our current policy, you might not feel as an art worker that you are an entrepreneur, but the government does think you're an entrepreneur. Remember when first the corona waves hit and our Secretary of State or Minister of Economic Affairs said we are not going to support freelancers because they decided for themselves to be entrepreneurs and this is their entrepreneurial risk. Well, I mean, that's of course not how it works in the arts. Many people don't choose to be an entrepreneur or a freelancer. It's the only way to work, but this is what we are dealing with in terms of policy. So what we do is we try to raise awareness and make actions. This is one we did in The Hague 2 years ago, called For Our Heroes. We did with Yuri Fehrman. We can see the next picture. These are 10... Did you remember when Rutte, the Prime Minister, started talking about all the heroes that kept the economy afloat during the COVID pandemic? And these are all the different types of heroes on a pedestal, but the height of the pedestal is according to their average income. So way on the left, probably you can't see, it's the shelf clerk in the supermarket. And just to the right of him is the artist with an average income of about 19,000 euros per month, per year, gross. And then to the right of them, I think, is the garbage collector. The cleaner, garbage collector, teacher, and then it goes up a little bit, like for police officer and journalist, around 55,000. But then the real gap happens when the Prime Minister is next and the CEO of KLM goes up here. And we also have an online version where there is a CEO of booking.com, but we couldn't erect the statue that was so we had to cut him up. So yeah, we try to put the position of the artist in the socioeconomic perspective and do that from a perspective of like broad solidarity with other precarious workers. We also recently wrote a letter to art academies asking for something like economically responsible art education that Silvio wrote a nice addendum to as well, that I recommend reading. And so that's one activity we do, and we go continue on. we try to also really push for a policy change. So who here has ever used the artist fee guideline, Kristen Arsene and Adam?
Did this exist?
Yes, this exists in the Netherlands, and it's actually embraced by the Minister of Culture in 2020. So in order to get government funding in any way, from the local government or the central government, art institutions have to comply with the artist fee guideline when you make an exhibition. So you see here on the right, there's an easy calculator on the website. If you're doing a solo show, you make a new work, for an exhibition of 1 month or shorter, you should get paid gross €7,747 minimum, excluding production. We can talk in more detail about this later, but that's not the main reason we are here today. We brought a few memes that we want to go through to kind of show the cliches we're dealing with. But what we mainly hope today is to start a conversation today about, you know, how can we balance our practice in such a way that you can keep doing on a longer term what you want to do. I wish I had less money and security so I could be a starving artist. This is what Hans Obing in Why Artists Are Poor calls the art ethos, which might sound very 19th century, but actually we find it still quite alive sometimes these days, especially also when it is told to you that you are doing your dream job, so you should be, you know, fine with doing it for very little money and forgetting that maybe people with less privilege or with kids can't really do that kind of unpaid labor or underpaid labor. Of course, we think that an artist is working all the time, right? You have no boundaries. Next one. They think that we can pay our groceries with exposure, right? And we should be grateful for the crazy and visual production of our work. We don't have the groceries anymore. Right, okay, so now we come actually to this is what we do, our perspective. Now we come to the core part of what we do today, which is actually to try to have a collective conversation with everyone here present, and we also invite you to, like all of you, participate, teachers, visitors, students, and kind of enter this conversation on an equal level as far as possible, or at least to engage it with each other in conversation equally. So I want to start off with some like formal questions, easy. Who here is registered at the Chamber of Commerce as a freelancer? Looks like it's around half.
55.
The most modest estimates of the whole cultural sector is that 60% of us work as freelancers. The estimates of visual arts go as high as 90%. So probably if you're studying and you're not yet registered at the KVK, it might be good to look into it and see how it can work for you. Another yes-no question. Would you work for free and contribute it to your professional practice or art practice?
No, but I have to do. It can be also another room.
We can also rephrase it. I have worked for free to promote my art practice. Yes. Can I say hands?
Very, very low.
Okay. Now I want to sometimes work for free to promote my art practice.
Once? I mean, right now.
You are paying once.
And now I would do it in the future if it was necessary.
Well,
I guess that is necessary. I mean, for me, personally, it depends, right? If it's like in an educational context, I would be much more willing to work for free. If it's in some kind of bigger institution, I would not want to have money. But that's, of course, also because I can afford it. For free, it's also not to say. I was at St. Joost like a few weeks ago. Someone said, okay, I would work for free, and then another classmate, 20 years old, said, well, I just had a baby. I used to do that, I can't do that anymore. So we have to also realize,
about the economic aspect of your publication. We also thought of a little game how to do it, because we are many people and we can't be in discussion all together at the same time. We also want to have a focused discussion. What we're going to do is do a game. It's called Fishbowl. So we prepared a couple of questions that you as a group can discuss or start a discussion about. So where the most space is there. The idea is that you start a circle of four persons there, and the rest can stand around. The idea is that the people in the middle, the four people, have the discussion, and if you want to join the discussion, you stand, go in the circle, and take part in the discussion. But that means that someone else has to step out. And you can be reloaded. Yeah?
You go here. Go.
So, yeah, I think the discussion should start with the people who made the publication. But it's also open for the rest of the public or cultural workers. I'm not sure if everybody's an artist here. So, who wants to start?
Two more.
Hello.
And you can take a bit of distance. You have to speak a bit up so everybody can listen. Okay, there are a couple of questions. I will go through them and I will decide based on how quick we go through questions. The first question is, how much money do you need each month?
$1 million. Do we need to make two circles? Like at least like one?
Yeah, so
we can have another one.
Yeah. So you can also start a circle there if you want.
I think I need 9,000. 9,000. No, I need a person.
I need 2,000.
Thank you.
We are also quite a big group, we're 12 people,
And we did have, also we're all very eager to all work together. We never wanted to split the group. And we did have a hard time finding a way to do that horizontally.
Yeah.
Which, like responding to this question, we did try to do it in a clear and fair way. But realistically, it never happens as such. Yeah. There's always imbalance. It might be shared imbalance. Some people might experience more stress at one point or the other.
But did you feel treated in an unfair way or something?
I was hurt. No, but that's the thing. I think we all care enough that it didn't happen in an unfair way, maybe.
Yeah.
I think it also really depends on person, like individually, how much a person can the energy everyone has, the interests everyone has. There's like a lot of different things to keep in mind.
And how did you decide what is fair and what not? Did you take into account each other's conditions or situations?
So that's also, I think
that's the thing that we did. Quite a lot.
But that's the thing. I think the hardest, to be honest, in a group is not necessarily a clear and fair distribution. It's rather clear and fair acquisition of tasks, so more what people can take and what actually their own limits.
Yeah, and just like pay attention to people's needs. I think
that's
fair.
That's yeah, but that happens more likely than actually people, I think, are more fair to others than themselves. That's more what I meant. I think. It's actually harder to put limits to yourself than actually with the people you collaborate with.
Yeah.
There's more care to others than yourself.
Can I step in and say something in the discussion?
Yes. Does someone need to step out?
So what is hard for me when I try to work on like equal level with someone is that you need to at some point make division of tasks, right? Because you can't do everything at the same time. And then you cannot always go and check on each other because you have to have this base of trust. So you like let go of each other, but you still want to know, you know, how to be able to check in with each other. So first, what Kun and me do each morning when we start working together, we go through our task lists, both of us, and like compare them and see like, maybe actually, you know, you can take over some of my tasks, I can take over some of your tasks. And then we're kind of like dividing it fairly for that one day. So that's one thing that helps us. It allows each other to work separately but equally.
Step in.
Yeah.
Imagine when you do it with 2 people, imagine doing it with 12.
Yeah.
Right, so how did you do it? Can you give us some insight?
So I think
we were just discussing for like 2 months. And then we just did the whole publication, made the whole publication like 2 weeks.
No, I mean, I think that
pressure is the key.
I think it takes time. And it takes time to understand each other and learn from each other. And in this case, I mean, we don't have so much time. So we have to like in 3 months to know each other, understand each other, understand everyone's needs, listen to everyone, all at the same time, and at the same time produce a publication that is not unacceptable.
And in that sense, we did have a trial. Like, we did a previous publication that didn't go as well. And I think that, like, actually the most work is getting to know each other. And, like, also, that's how you actually also learn how to work together, what different people can actually get from and also contribute. And I do think it's actually interesting that we have such a stubborn group and we really want to collaborate, even though it's actually really difficult. And there's a tiny joke going around that we're doing a master's in decision making. And we've done a lot actually of different formats also of collaboration.
Yeah.
So different moderation, different facilitating.
Even right? Tried out role plays.
Yeah.
We actually, every meeting almost is a new experience of how to listen to each other and give space to each other.
And then
like,
at some point you realize you've been listening too much to each other and you're kind of tired of it, so we need to do it less. And come on.
That
you need to do it less, because at some point it becomes stressing to like take care of everyone continuously, But I think that we're finding the balance after
something. Yes. And did you experience also harder because of a culture factor? Because if I'm not mistaken, you all come from different countries.
Yeah.
And that makes it also, I think, a step harder to work in a group because, well, you don't know each other, because then, yeah, a no for someone is, like, for some cultures, it's a no-go. While, like, other people are more...
Yeah, it's really about the miscommunication.
Yeah.
I think it's more about miscommunication more or misunderstandings,
yeah,
more than not being willing to, because we obviously already know we come from different countries and we have different ways of seeing things.
Mm-hmm.
We now have a new question.
Switch!
I don't know how to answer.
Maybe
yes,
we can broaden up this question a little bit also to the public here and rephrase it. What side jobs did you take on in order to be able to keep up your professional artistic practice? In your case, making this publication. So, I mean, it's clear, right, this happened in an educational context, but you are now presenting it in a context where people might get money for it, so, like, we are bridging this, like, professional and educational context, and I would say maybe you are entering the professional context with this as well. I will start. I'm now in a very happy position not to have any side jobs. But I was always a babysitter, and I got €9 per hour for that. I felt very happy with that because I liked to do it, but it's not so much.
I think there's only one right answer to this question, that's investing in bitcoins.
No.
Yeah, I actually also did babysitting, worked as a bartender, you know, distributing flyers and all such stuff.
Yeah. So I must say, I'm very lucky, yet also in this narrow system of I'm working for the institution I'm graduated from. So it's also kind of like recycling its own tools and keeping kind of like... It's within the family, which can be questionable sometimes, institutionalized. But that's how this and freelance, but my main income is actually working for an institution and studying.
Very good.
I'm a full-time freelancer. It's super tricky because I moved to Netherlands from a country where more or less prices are 2 or 3 times less, like cheaper. So most of my clients, of course, are still from my previous network, so I get paid 3 or 2 times less than it should be, and it's, I try to take as many jobs as I can, so I work 2 or 3 times more in order to pay my rent.
To the side of
making
this.
One minute. While studying, while working, everything.
No, what one?
Okay, we're going to the next question.
Right. I think this is this is also an interesting question to the whole public, right? What would you expect to be the components to price the publication?
Turn your head.
Sorry. Everyone went different direction.
Your eyes must look.
I was like, what?
Yeah, so if you walk into a bookshop and you see a book, what components do you think make up the price? The content? Meaning, like...
The author.
So, investment banking is worth €100, and art is worth €10?
No, no.
Topic? Art, let's say, if it's a topic that really interests me, that I think could be useful for...
All right, so that's what you're willing to pay for it. But what do you think is, like, there is a price tag on it already, right?
I mean, for real,
yeah.
Graphic design, after
yeah.
It.
Yeah.
It depends if it's independent distribution or you are a distributor.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, you can get like 50% of that price tag that it goes to the distribution.
Right.
What about the labor?
That's the smallest part.
That's the smallest.
It's a little bit of paper.
And you want to write
it?
Sorry? If you just keep finding, that means that you achieve the same value. What can make the price?
Makes the price lower. Right?
Yeah.
But it's being made by others.
Yeah.
And who's going to buy
so
it?
So the sales price then. Yeah. So when a book is 30 euros, you're like, okay, probably book somewhere from this, but like the labor is paid for in funding. Is that the standard in art publishing?
Yes.
Does anyone want to come and discuss the pricing of this? Anyone be
yeah.
Yeah.
So here you have the price tag in this frame. I don't think everyone can see it, but we wanted to be transparent about certain information. So the production cost, which we were of course able to trace back, the retailer fee, which actually haven't been announced yet, how much PLF takes from the price, the sale. Yeah, we mentioned it, but we didn't like. And then the VAT for publication, which is 9%. And then, actually, when it came to trying to quantify the labor cost, we know we worked 3 months on it, but how much of these 3 months was work? Was it only the times we were in school, following the classes, or was it also when we were just brainstorming outside of school, when we were just like under the shower thinking? When we were also talking about it with people outside of the course. And then it was really hard to define this quantity of work that we put in making these books and conceptualizing. But also the production costs are covered by the Pitzvart. And then we actually pay Pitzvart for covering this publication.
Oops.
Me. We are paying the school for covering the production, and we also are unable to trace the amount of labor we produce. And yeah, because we're unable to set a price, we also wanted to open this discussion to everyone who is considering to buy the book box and decide for themselves how much they would like to pay for it.
Did you ever consider making the possibility of making back your tuition fee? Or
and then maybe pay the rent?
Can I leave a draft? No. Yeah. I think we want people to reflect. We don't just want people to get stuff for free. So if we say you can also not pay anything, but at least think about it. I mean, you can say this price is not set, so it's your decision, right? And it means you can pay 0 or 100, even if the production cost is 24 and we don't know how much we spent on it or whatever. But it is like, if I say it's free, people will just get it. And that's.
Is it also not something that you have to put in consideration that if it ends up in a private library, or whether it says it comes in a public institution, like in how far can the work be redistributed by publishing, producing it, and then make it available and accessible for others to see it?
Yeah.
It's important.
Yeah. So as a non-student, I think I also paid a lot for this book box. look at the difference between the amounts. Yeah, it's crazy. So basically,
you're sponsoring.
So we have this thing going on with the EU and non-EU students. It's very rich and a lot of layers.
And we do also on the
not a lesser subject, but we did want to take into account people's income and accessibility to this kind of publications. So it is also the idea that if you can afford the equivalent of multiple publication, maybe in a way you sponsor someone else's access to the publication that would have a lesser income to invest in it. So this is also something that we had into account on a more individual level, that is good for you to take into account. We don't want to like also guilt people into investing in the publication. It's also what do you think you are able to contribute on an individual level, honestly, actually, and not only on a conceptual level.
Did also maybe considerations come up around, okay, this is part of my educational process, I don't want to think about money for this, or I want it to be accessible for everyone, so was there a certain resistance also in putting a price tag on it?
I think we were just confused because of course it's part of our education, but we are in this shop, and the shop is not like an institution for education. It's actually a shop. So we're in between. We have a few
education. And who earns from this book?
Sorry?
Who earns from this book? Is it the shop or is it
me? So.
Actually, yeah, we just couldn't answer the question ourselves. So we were so busy with other things that this question that we couldn't answer so easily, we just like postponed. And to this day, we still don't know what we're going to make or like to invest in with this money.
Did you like just for fun try to calculate if you would give yourself a low hourly fee of 20 euros?
It was like too many numbers that I cannot remember. The number.
It's too expensive.
No. Because we're
like what range? Like what price range are we thinking?
You mean like
the estimation
of the real price?
Yeah, if I would actually calculate your own hours.
Well, we've been working on it for more than 2 months with like 12 students and then still like a handful of teachers and like every week worked at least like for 8 hours per day, five days a week. So it's going to become insanely expensive.
Okay, well, how about we calculate it based on the minimum wage in the Netherlands, which is 1700 euros per month per person. So 12 times 1700, this is monthly one, times 3.
Was it 3 or 2 months?
I mean,
this
is 200
per month. Divided by
100.
612.
So 612 euros is only for the hours.
No production.
Yeah.
No facilities.
So with the first production, that's the separate purchases.
I need to get a loan to buy this.
I said it would be easy.
Take
all this car.
Attention, please. Last question.
How do you redistribute the revenue in a collective way?
Equal.
Do you each take an equal part?
Yes.
Do you together invest it into something you want to? Do you, in the current circumstances, want to give it to refugee relief? How do you make these decisions?
Let's make a pot for you. Sorry.
Cocktail generator.
Sorry.
Actually, I think we had this discussion once. I'm not sure we had it multiple times with the whole group. And we immediately, at the time, we didn't know what we wanted the publication to be worth. And we were actually, for some reason, we pictured the income to be reinvested in the same project. So, but I think at that time we had the more accessible notion of the publication. And we never thought of it as being something that would benefit individually, it would also come back to the collective. And I think, yeah, it was kind of a direct reinvestment in the collective that produced it. And maybe more directly the same project, like we could produce more of them. But ultimately, it would benefit the next publication because every time the income or like the funding is cushioned anyways, and what we can invest and how that investment benefits the public as much as us as a collective. So also within an institution, I think it never came up to us as an individual benefit.
Because I think we tried to have this discussion with Michael, like what happens to the money that comes. So because we can actually spend as much as we want in the production of the books, but what happens really like in the administration of school, like
the
and he was also not really able to give an answer. I heard like things have to go under the table. Like we can't officially earn money from it. But I don't really remember what was the term exactly that you said, Michael.
It's a cash.
Do you maybe want to elaborate the institutional limits?
It's a bit vague, you know? Like when
what I said was from an institutional point of view, there's no way to process revenue.
Yeah. But that's already like the first. Like,
so you're basically, it's a heavily subsidized project. I mean, also, all the money that we receive as an educational institution, in part, you know, the tuition is only a part of it. I mean, actually, also the thing was to say the difference between those two numbers is what we also receive from the European Union as support for our existence as an educational institution. So it's more just like on paper, there's no place to structurally process profit. Actually, it would just maybe could take it against your budget, but it actually doesn't really make any sense. So
I have another question. Because you won't earn anything from it, but what you get is, I think, educational profit. You can, because you learn something out of this process. How do you decide how many hours you put in this project? Maybe you can also elaborate it. What's the workload that you put on the students, and how do you decide it? And does it differ per student? Maybe, or how do you keep guard on the hours that you put in this publication?
Yeah, we didn't, and that's why it was so hard to also. It's we didn't keep track of like actual hours that we spent producing or meeting or being in class. And also when we try to trace back, it's really hard to make the cut between what is actually labor for the publication and what is just like us being answering messages in the evening or on Sunday on Telegram because like we need to plan something from Monday.
Yeah.
Like does that count into the
labor?
Yeah. How do we trace back how much hours we actually spend?
Well,
messages
one way would be, for instance, to set a clear boundary. I need to take care of a family member. I cannot receive texts after 6, and if I do, I won't reply to them until next morning.
But I remember from my studies that for each course, there were certain limits of hours that were reserved to that course, or it was also for this course you need to invest 4 hours a week. So for this course you need to invest 6 hours a week. It's also based on the workload that we would get, on how many articles we should read or what assignments we should talk. Is it also the case here, or is it a bit loose?
Yeah,
Well, from one point of view, it's very strict and very, I mean, it's very structured. The course actually focuses on 3 days a week with the explicit idea that though we call it a full-time course, we leave time for instance, we schedule things Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays with the idea that people often are working in parallel to the course because they need to. In terms of all the hours of staff, that's very fixed. So I mean, the special issue is indeed very much the focus. But there's technical support, there's writing support, and all the hours are absolutely accounted for and fixed. I mean, what's a bit, you know, it's often kind of contradictional, maybe, because it, in a way, we have this construct of special issue to sort of force a sort of production deadline. But in some ways, it's also very, we're often talking about actually the sort of production mode as the thing we dread, in a sense that as an educational institution, what we're trying to do is really promote people to take on different roles, to try new ways of working. And so there's a whole agenda that, of course, is not, strictly speaking, there just for making a publication. It's actually, our goal is actually education. So, I don't know if that's a...
Well, I mean, I guess we should round off now, but I can just say a few words about why we find it so important to discuss this economic aspect of a student project or any artistic work. It's, you know, there's this idea, of course, still that, you know, if you're an artist or an art working, you do your dream job, you just keep doing it, you don't look at your hours, you don't look at your paychecks. But in the end, it's also a question of what kind of structures do you need to keep doing what you want to do on the longer term. So, I mean, you could say there is a tension between autonomy and entrepreneurship. You can also say there is a direct relation between agency and financial stability, right? So, and we find that in order to create financial stability, to do what you do on a longer term and keep doing it also when you have a family, you have a sick family member, you have different circumstances that, you know, don't allow you to just keep going and not make money, that you need to have agreements with other people, understandings with each other, so we find it really important to have this conversation. But we also find it important to create institutional and policy structures that allow for durable economic relationships, exactly in order to allow for artistic freedom and reflection and critique. And in that sense, maybe we should end on the note of the Fair Practice Code.
This is an example for...
This is actually really...
So in, I think, in 2017, Fame House of Performance as a theater in Amsterdam decided that they will only open for 100 days in that year because they would only get a certain amount of funding. And they calculated how much labor they could put in to the institution by still having a fair wages for the people working for that specific theater, so they only decided to open for 100 days. So you actually see production houses looking more realistically to how to keep a sustainable institution
I mean, it's very simple. They say, okay, we need this amount of money. Okay, we get only one third, then we do only one third. And they made a statement out of it. And it worked very well. But then, of course, you know, after 2 years, the kind of the political claim like wears off. It just becomes you lose your visibility. It's a vicious circle, cycle. So they have to open again 365 days per year, which they still are today. We don't really have to discuss the breadth financial. We also find it important to emphasize that, okay, our precarious workers are everywhere in all sectors of Dutch society, so we also need to, you know, self-organize and discuss this kind of plans. We should always discuss this kind of arrangements, but we should also accompany it with the claims for UBI and other social security systems. This is a beautiful example of solidarity between an artist and domestic workers.
What is it with the art?
Universal basic income. And I think if you are wondering, you know, what kind of discussions and agreements are already existing, the Fair Practice Code has been adopted by the government as a funding requirement for any work in the cultural sector, and it includes five core values: solidarity, transparency, sustainability, trust, and diversity. But more importantly, it has three core principles: fair chain, fair share, and fair pay. And those are actually very concrete, arguments. If you ever go into a conversation with an institution and you're not sure how to create a fair working condition, you can use these. And we are also always there if you want, you know, some help with interpretation, or you have doubts, you can come to us tonight or any other day. Yes? But if you plan on working in the Dutch cultural sector for a bit of a longer time, I really do suggest reading this. It's worth it. And even though it's maybe a little bit vague, you can see where the policy discussion is at and where to place yourself within that, and to, you know, have this discussion with peers around actually making that concrete.
I think one of the most important things that the sector is at now is that all these values, we all subscribe to it, that we want to uphold these five values. The question for us also, for Boston Bikas, also in discussion with you, is how to put these different values into practice. So what does solidarity mean in your collaborative work? How do you practice transparency in your institution? What does a sustainable art practice mean? So I think that it's important for each discussion, or if you are going into collaborative cultural work, either in a group of cultural workers or with institutions, try to always implement these discussions about these values. And the Fair Practice Code is really good, like an umbrella or
a toolbox
for you to start these discussions. So visit the website or get in contact with us. And I think we will leave it there. And
then
you can go back to the bar.
I found you for a reason.
Oosh.
Welcome to my productive space. Here play meets work. Time is ordered in unusual ways, and patterns unravel. Together we mess with the boundaries between leisure and labor. How are your boundaries? Maybe you shouldn't go to work tomorrow. But could you really follow your own schedule? Would you be more productive if you chose when to work? I never rest, and I never work. I found you for a reason. I fall apart when I'm exposed. I fall apart when you open me. This is the place to play. It becomes your own productive space. You can curate your own experience, make it more or less expensive, an individual experience or a collective one. Put me back together. However you decide to take care of me, remember, I found you for a reason. Make all the notes you find inside me your own. curate them, spread them, mark them, scratch them, add to them, subtract from them, play with them. Lay them on any surface and reorganize them. This is your playground. Nothing needs to come from it, and anything can come from it. Take a moment to reflect on how you and others spend time. Take everything from it. Deny everything. You are in control. We found each other for a reason. We found each other for a reason. Do you dare to purchase me?
Whoa!
Thank you.
Got one.
key, maybe?
I don't think any of these questions.
And it's just a guy.
Is it invisible?
Ah, yes!
It's too much strong.
Congratulations, this was your self-contained blue box!
That's the label. Is it included?
I'm going to go to the next one. special issue.
I'm going to go to the next one.
many of the best which I don't, always pisses me off, and I always feel really like, why do you need to have a conversation like that? You can go outside. And it's just like, it's okay that you're not
I'm going to go to the next one.
times, but I think it is.
Yeah. I got my own books. Yes. Of course I did. And I did like a little unboxing These are all the
I'm going to go to the hospital.